We're talking about our state's regulatory processes here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. Guidance documents. These documents tell businesses in our state how to comply with state agency rules, and they essentially explain agency rules to the public. And when lawmakers met last December, they made a law requiring that guidance documents get a public review process. Act 369 restricts the use of guidance documents that help interpret rules for the public. So we're looking closer at this as several agencies opened a comment period for less than a day. Do you use state agencies' guidance documents? What do you use them for? Would you take advantage of a public comment period? We're at 800-642-1234. Bill Leaders is editor of The Progressive. He's president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. Bill, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
It's good to be here.
Well, before we get started, can you explain what guidance documents are, what they're used for?
Yeah, you did a pretty good job. These are instructions that are developed by state agencies to explain their rules to members of the public. It may be, you know, suggestions for how to apply for funding or programs. It may be guidance to regulated industries about what their requirements are under a particular statute. And for years, these were just promulgated by agencies without any sort of requirement that they invite public opinion about them. But some regulated groups felt that they wanted to have more to say about these guidance documents. In some cases, they were amounting to policy being made in the interpretation, and so they wanted to have input. So among the things that the legislature did in that infamous lame duck session last December, which included measures to strip the governor and the attorney general of some of their powers, was to require that these guidance documents have to go through a process of public comment. They'd be published in the public register, and then the law says that there has to be at least 21 days of public comment that that is set before they are enacted.
And they have to publish these documents on their websites as well.
Right. So the public knows what is being proposed and has, according to the law, at least 21 days of a comment period in which to respond. Now, there is a provision in that law which says that the governor can set a comment period of less than 21 days. He has to do that, give permission to the agency to have a comment period of less than 21 days. And what happened, and which caught my eye in my capacity with the Freedom of Information Council, was that in several cases, state agencies went to the governor and asked for permission to have a comment period of 0 days.
How did that happen?
Well, they were under a timeline that made a 21-day schedule impossible because of the way that the court ruled, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on some of these challenges to the lame duck bills in June, and the deadline for passing and having the comment periods was July 1st. So there just wasn't time. But instead of saying, well, give us a comment period of 3 days or 7 days, three agencies asked for a comment period of 0 days.
So this is Department of Public Instruction, Department of Corrections, and Department of Workforce Development?
Yes, those three agencies. And the Department of Health Services had a comment period of 1 day for another set of guidance documents.
So do you think agencies will follow this protocol in the future of asking the governor to have these exceptions?
I kind of doubt it. I think that one of the reasons for calling attention to the fact that it happened now is to raise a concern about it. Absent this pending court deadline, I don't know that they would have the chutzpah to set 0 day comment periods into the future. That just seems to me unlikely as a political, but we'll see. I mean, they could. The law gives them that ability. And in this instance, they did invoke that ability to have a comment period of essentially no time at all.
talking with Bill Leaders. He's editor of The Progressive, and he's been looking into state regulatory practices and these guidance documents. We're talking about how these documents now require a comment period following a revision in the statute during December's extraordinary legislative session. Do you see a need for a public comment period for state agencies' guidance documents? Do you send in your thoughts and opinions when state agencies make new rules? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Bill, the law states that the governor has to approve any comment period shorter than 21 days, as you explained. How has the Evers administration responded to these much shorter windows?
Well, it approved them. So, I mean, it granted the agency request to have the short windows. I should say that the governor's office and the agencies themselves argue that there still is opportunity for the public to comment on these things. The fact that there's a formal comment period does not mean that that's the only time you could have offer a thought about them, or the only time the agencies would pay attention to it. That, you know, even without a formal comment period, anyone can comment on any of these guidance documents and say, I think you got this wrong. I think this could be better. They also say that they haven't received any input from the agencies that had a zero-day comment period, that nobody came subsequent and said, you know, I really want to weigh in on this. So it isn't a matter in which there's routinely large numbers of groups or individuals just dying to weigh in on these documents. But the intention of the law was to formalize a process of input. I should say that that was of great concern to many of these agencies. The requirements of the law created a huge new burden on the agencies and would potentially have gummed up the process of interpreting rules for the public. There was a real potential downside that a lot of people were and still are concerned about, that this law aimed to check the power of the governor really just gums up the mechanism for everyone.
Well, help me understand here. There's this court brief that was filed in May. There are at least 200,000 guidance documents that can be defined as guidance documents across all state agencies. All of them would have to have public hearings and be subjected to other administrative standards. So where are we at with that process, and how does it relate to the public comment period?
It's unclear, at least to me, whether there really is a need for all 200,000 of these guidance documents to go through a review process, or just how cumbersome that would be. It may be a matter of noticing things and allowing a comment period. The public hearing thing would be logistically extremely difficult, but maybe it could be done with, you know, you hold a comment period on 20,000 guidance documents all at once. If you want to comment on any of these things, this is your opportunity to come. I mean, there's ways you could do it that would lessen the burden, I presume. But yeah, I don't know what is actually going to happen in terms of giving notice and having hearings on all of these documents.
Going back to something you said there, some people have argued that having a public comment period is necessary to prevent agencies from using guidance documents to essentially create new rules under the table. Have we seen anything like that?
I think some of the regulated groups feel as though the guidance that was crafted by state agencies amounted to the making of rules. The proposal to create a new comment period was backed by, for instance, Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the big business lobby group. And they feel that, you know, this was an opportunity for some agencies to actually make policy and not just interpret it. And they wanted a foot in the door. And they supported this change in the law. They filed briefs before the Supreme Court issued its ruling in June, arguing for that input.
We're talking with Bill Leaders, president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. Coming up, we'll get an update on a lawsuit brought by the McIver Institute accusing Governor Evers of excluding its journalists from press briefings. What are your thoughts on that? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll talk more in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and we're talking with the head of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council, Bill Leaders, is with us. The MacIver Institute filed a lawsuit earlier this month in federal court and alleges Governor Evers' office excluded the news outlet from media events. So what are your thoughts on the MacIver Institute's lawsuit against the Evers administration? Who do you think is in the right here? Join in 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Bill Leaders stays with us. So, Bill, the conservative-leading MacIver Institute sued the Evers administration in federal court. What do we know about the background leading up to this lawsuit?
Well, MacIver News Service says that it was denied entrance to a press briefing that other media were allowed to attend. It also says that when it asked to be put on the media send list for press events and other information from the governor's office, that did not happen. That the governor's office selectively excluded it from receiving these notices and barred its reporters from attending one of these briefings. So it filed a lawsuit in federal court challenging those denials as a violation of the organization's free press rights, and that case is pending. Now, my group promptly weighed in on this, and I gave a statement in support of the MacIver Institute and expressed that I felt that MacIver should be afforded all of the courtesies as any other news organization. I also expressed that I thought that if Tony Evers has what it takes to be governor, he ought to be able to withstand the inclusion of conservative media at press events. It's petty, I think, and it's probably illegal for the governor's office to selectively exclude certain media, presumably because they don't like the media and its message.
Can you help us understand who the MacIver Institute is, a little bit about their history and what they publish?
Well, it's a conservative think tank based in Wisconsin. I know it receives money from the Bradley Foundation and other conservative groups. It does run this news service, which does reporting on state news primarily. It does have a conservative point of view. It's a free market oriented philosophy, and they do have a pretty good record, I think, when it comes to support for open government. Many conservative groups do have a good record in supporting our open meetings and our open records law, and that's certainly true of MacIver.
How has the Evers administration responded to this?
Well, they did not deny that they excluded a reporter from this press event. And so far as I know, they have not denied that they would not include the group on its send list. They may have rectified that or intend to rectify that. They should rectify that and include the group. I think they... indications now are that they will fight the lawsuit. Maybe they'll offer some sort of settlement, which will mean that the state will end up paying MacIver something in terms of its legal cost in order to settle the lawsuit. I don't know that. I don't know that there's a settlement in the works, but that is always a possibility that government will settle rather than go through a protective lawsuit process in which in the end it might lose. Now, why would I say it might lose? Well, it's the most comparable case that I can think of to this was what happened with Jim Acosta at CNN last year when the Trump administration revoked Jim Acosta's press credentials, and CNN sued, and a judge issued an injunction overturning the revocation of Jim Acosta's press credentials. And then the government caved and said, okay, he can have his press credentials. We're not going to fight anymore. And it settled the case with CNN. So that's a prior example that is comparable. It doesn't appear to be legal for government to selectively exclude media because it doesn't like a particular reporter or it doesn't like a particular news outlet. Now, government can be selective about who it extends special access to. Like, no one would dispute the ability of President Trump to give an interview
exclusive
to Sean Hannity,
right.
But not to Rachel Maddow. I mean, he has that freedom to give additional access, but I don't think that governments are on constitutionally sound ground sound footing when they selectively exclude media from access that other media have.
We're looking at press freedom now with Bill Leaders. He's editor of The Progressive, president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. What are the governor's responsibilities when it comes to maintaining freedom of the press and equal access to his administration, in your opinion? Is it okay for lawmakers to block certain accounts on social media? Join in with your thoughts here, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Bill, let's look at another lawsuit, the One Wisconsin Now's lawsuit against Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Representative John Nygren, both who are Republicans. One Wisconsin Now is a liberal cause. And they're looking at this through Twitter and the blocking on Twitter. Can you tell us more about this suit, which is filed in 2017 and then decided this January?
Yeah, the One Wisconsin Now, a liberal advocacy group, did sue three members of the Wisconsin State Legislature, including Robin Voss and John Nygren, for blocking their access to the legislators' social media accounts. This also has a federal parallel where a number of groups and individuals sued President Trump for selectively blocking access to his Twitter account. And in that case, the courts ruled against Trump and in favor of the requesters in Wisconsin. The courts ruled against the legislators and in favor of One Wisconsin Now. The most recent development in that case, which was decided in January, is that the state has agreed to pay the legal fees for One Wisconsin Now, and it's $200,000, which is a huge chunk of change. We need to remember that this is money that's coming out of the taxpayers' pocket for the bad decision to try to defend in court a policy of exclusion of certain individuals because lawmakers didn't like those individuals. There was another case that I was personally involved in where I sued Representative Scott Krug for denying access to electronic copies of records that I requested in electronic form. That case I also won in the court level. I won my case was affirmed at the appellate court level, and the state has agreed to pay legal costs. I think that just happened this week. That was about $100,000. So just in these two cases, taxpayers have had to shell out about a third of $1 million, $300,000, in order to pay for the failed efforts of members of the legislature to pursue a policy of secrecy.
Why are these issues going to court in the first place? Why can't they be settled through conversations, through negotiations?
See, that's always my first preference, and I would urge anyone who has a beef with a public official to do everything they can, short of litigation, in order to get the records they need or the access that they need. But sometimes they just say no. And the only way you can force the issue is to bring a lawsuit. Now, this is a risky proposition to sue because there's no guarantee that you're going to win. But if you do win, the law says that you are entitled to recovery of your legal cost, and these can be substantial, and in both of these cases, they were.
Do you anticipate seeing more lawsuits like this as constituents have more ways to get access to their lawmakers, especially on social media, Twitter?
I think we're going to see more lawsuits like this because there's a culture of contempt for the public's right to know, which I think is taking heart among certain members of the state legislature. I think this is something new that we've seen in the last 5 years or so. I wouldn't have said this was true before, but I do think it's true now that there are certain members of the legislature who are fundamentally opposed to the notion that they should be held accountable to the people through open records and the open meetings law, and they're determined to embrace as much secrecy as they can get away with, and that is going to result in more lawsuits. One of the tricks that they're doing now is to charge huge sums of money to locate the records, because the law does allow to records custodians to charge a fee for their cost of locating records. Now they say, oh, it took us 20 hours and it's going to cost you $1,000. If you want these records, you have to pay us that $1,000 for the location energy that we put into it.
It used to be the cost of making copies.
Yeah, and you know, one of the clues that these charges are bogus is sometimes reporters will make multiple requests or request to multiple officials for a certain category of records and say 3 out of 4 of the officials they asked for records will say, here's your records, no charge. And then there'll be a legislator who'll say, if you want these records, you owe me $700.
So it's not even across the board is what you're
saying. Well, I think that there's evidence that some lawmakers are using their ability to charge location fees abusively in order to frustrate requesters and keep them from getting the records that they deserve.
Bill, thank you for joining us.
Sure.
Bill Leaders is editor of The Progressive and president of the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council. Coming up, we look at large-scale industrial farming and how it impacts rural life here in Wisconsin. Farmers, we want to hear from you. How do you manage runoff? What strategies have you put into practice for your farm operation? And what's your take on putting a moratorium on CAFOs, these large livestock operations? We're at 800-642-1234. We'll look at issues hitting family farms right after this news update on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the growth in large-scale farms, these concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The number of CAFOs here in Wisconsin has risen every year since 2005. The vast majority are dairy operations. But now a few Wisconsin counties and municipalities are putting a temporary block on these mega farms. Do you live in a county with a CAFO moratorium? What's your take on the policy? What environmental concerns do you have about phosphorus and nitrate pollution? Have you noticed the impact? If you're a farmer, how do you balance your farm's business model for growth with environmental concerns? We're at 800-642-1234. Erin Jordan is an investigative reporter for The Gazette in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where she covers agriculture and water quality issues. Erin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's a real pleasure.
Well, let's start by looking at these moratoriums. Burnett County passed a one-year moratorium on large-scale farms with 1,000 or more animals. We saw Eau Claire County and then the township of Marietta. They implemented similar rules. What are these local governments trying to do here?
Well, I think the idea of a moratorium is just to allow the township or the county time to consider the ramifications of these different facilities, maybe to look at what's happened in other places when some of these large facilities have come in, to maybe look at the record of the people who are planning to operate it and see whether they've had water quality issues in other places. And, you know, just to, I think, frankly, they just want to slow down the expansion of these large-scale facilities. You know, in Iowa, there's been a real push from some environmental groups to get a statewide moratorium, and that just hasn't moved forward. But I think it's some of the same ideas.
Why hasn't a statewide moratorium moved forward? What have been the roadblocks there?
Well, you know, primarily it's just, you know, farmers. They say, well, this is our land. We have a right to do with it what we need to do in order to, you know, make money for our, you know, our family. You know, it's no secret it's been a tough time for agriculture, both on the dairy side and also in the commodity side. So, you know, some of these farmers, you know, in order to make ends meet, have decided to use a relatively small portion of their land, maybe to put up a hog confinement. And that has maybe helped them pay the bills during these tough times.
And we'll get to hogs in just a moment here. But what do you make of a county-by-county regulation approach to CAFOs? Is that the best way to regulate CAFOs?
I mean, I think it makes sense because different counties or townships have different sentiments about development. And, you know, I think, you know, it's kind of that idea of local control. And if the people locally want to take time to study it, it seems to make sense to do it that way instead of maybe taking too broad of an approach statewide. And maybe if it starts at a local level and expands out, maybe that's a better way to go than trying to get something passed at a statewide level and being unsuccessful.
Aaron, do we know what economic impact these moratoriums have had on business development in their areas? Do you have any sense there or numbers?
I don't know. You know, I think it's relatively new these areas are trying it. I'm sure those that are arguing against moratorium would say, hey, while we put this hold on development, we're going to lose out on these major operations that could provide jobs, that could provide tax revenue. So, you know, we may be looking to Wisconsin to see how it's working in those counties.
Well, let's look at Hogs here for a moment. In Burnett County, where they just passed this one-year moratorium on CAFOs of 1,000 or more animal units, as they say, an Iowa company announced plans for a 26,000 hog operation. What is the state of hog farming in the Midwest?
Yeah, you know, it's really huge. In Iowa has 7 pigs to each human in Iowa, which I think is kind of baffling. There's 20 million pigs being raised each year in Iowa, according to the Iowa pork producers. So in Wisconsin, I just was looking at some data online. It looked like there were about 325,000 hogs in Wisconsin. So quite a bit less, and that's probably because of the dairy industry, you know, being the primary focus there. But I do wonder, you know, that operation that you mentioned moving into Burnett County, that is going to be run by an Iowa company, Cumberland LLC or Suede Health. I don't know how that's pronounced. And so I think that there may be some expansion. It seems to me it's not necessarily a coincidence that the areas that have put these moratoriums on are kind of near the Iowa border. I wonder if there's just concern that hog industry could be expanding across from Iowa into Wisconsin more than it has, or maybe more than we've seen those hog facilities from other places.
We're looking at the growth of CAFOs, these large livestock operations, with Erin Jordan. She's an investigative reporter for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. She covers egg and water quality issues. Farmers, we want to hear from you. Do you live in a county with a CAFO moratorium? What's your take on the policy? What would you like to see from state government on the issue of water quality and management? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Aaron, help us understand what an animal unit measurement is and how does it differ from dairy cows to hogs to beef cattle?
That's right. Yeah, I think this is can be interesting. So the moratoriums that you've described are for facilities of 1,000 animal units or more. So one animal unit is equivalent to one beef cow. So 1,000 animal units would be 1,000 beef cows. But because milking cows are larger, that's only about 715 milking cows. 1,000 animal units is equivalent to about 2,500 finishing hogs. So those are the largest hogs. So it sometimes can be a little misleading when you see 1,000 animal units if you don't know those conversions.
So they really take into account the animal's size in order to understand what a total animal unit is.
Right. And I think the big thing, too, is because they're looking at what these animals produce. So, you know, they're looking at the manure, how much space they would take up, and that kind of thing. So you could see why they might want to have it be equivalent for different size animals.
We've seen Wisconsin losing dairy farms at record-breaking numbers. The state lost 638 farms last year. Farmers are trying to expand or diversify their operations to stay above board. How have you seen hog operations factor into that?
Well, I don't have all the numbers for Wisconsin, but there is a fantastic series that the Journal Sentinel has been doing, you know, talking with farmers about the challenging times in the dairy industry. And, you know, some of those folks have tried to, you know, get into cheese, adding a creamery, things like that. But if you can, you know, further diversify and open up a hog facility, that may help you as well, you know, to kind of have more stability across markets. You know, it doesn't take a lot of land on your facility, you know, to have a hog confinement. You don't need to have grazing or, you know, maybe as much space as you might for a milking facility. So it may be that some farmers are looking to expand that direction.
Well, you would still have to deal with manure and what you're going to do with the waste. What have we seen there in terms of how manure is disposed of, spread on these CAFO operations?
Yeah, that's something that's been really interesting in my reporting. So most of these operations across the Midwest, if they are of a certain size or you know, like medium to large, they have to have a manure management plan, which shows where they're going to, how they're going to dispose of the manure generated by their animals. And I've talked to a number of folks in this industry who say that it's really not profitable if you have to haul your manure more than maybe 7-8 miles away from your facility. So you need to find a plan, find a farmer, whether it's, you know, your own corn, soybean acres or another farmer who wants you to spread the manure there. And often they do because it's, you know, it's a very rich fertilizer for your land. But if you get to a place where the density of these operations is so high that there may not be enough land to spread the manure without making it too expensive by having to haul it a longer distance.
And that's what's happening in Northwest Iowa.
Yes, there's a couple of areas in Northwest Iowa and kind of spreading into South Dakota that are just, it's such high density that they're having trouble a little bit, or they may be approaching it having enough places to haul their manure. And one of the risks there is that farmers may start applying it at a rate that is too high, that's higher than the recommended rate. There was a great study that the University of Iowa did this last year where they looked at how much nitrate had been applied in some of these areas, and they found it was 2 to 3 times the recommended rate, and that they believe that is linked to just the high density of the CAFOs.
Well, when you talk with environmental groups, what is their approach? What CAFO regulations and farm practices are they in favor of?
I think that you know, some folks who are you know, environmental researchers have you know, they would like to see some pretty drastic changes. Others are really fairly reasonable. They think, you know, we could really make just a few minor changes and maybe have some dramatic impact in terms of water quality, you know, not farming in floodplains any longer. You know, we've seen just with climate change, we've seen more and more floods. Well, if you're not planting in the floodplain, that could be very helpful. Perhaps not doing fall, just trying to avoid fall tillage, going to no-till if possible, just so you don't have this exposed soil that can erode over the course of the winter. So I think some of these guys think you could just make a few minor changes and make a big improvement.
We're talking with Erin Jordan. She's an investigative reporter for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Do you live in a rural community? What challenges have you seen when it comes to water quality? We're at 800-642-1234 talking about CAFOs. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're looking at large livestock operations, these CAFOs, and the growth of them here in Wisconsin. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The number of CAFOs in our state has more than doubled since 2005. The largest dairy CAFO in Wisconsin houses more than 9,000 cows. Manure is a big concern we've been talking about. CAFOs are regulated under the Federal Clean Water Act. What environmental concerns do you have about phosphorus and nitrate pollution? Have you noticed the effect here in Wisconsin? Do you live in a county with a CAFO moratorium? What's your take on the policy? Join in, 800-642-1234. Erin Jordan stays with us. She's an investigative reporter at the Gazette in Cedar Rapids, where she covers ag and water issues. Let's go to the phones now with Jerry joining us from Wilton. Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
Go ahead.
We live in a small town, and there's a farm right right in town with an open manure pit that it exudes terrible, terrible smells very frequently. I just wondered if there's anything the residents can do to have the farmer abate those smells or do something to prevent all of those horrible smells almost every day.
Yeah, thank you, Jerry. Erin, what are the regulations around odor management?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that, Jerry. There's right now, the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture is taking public comment on a proposal that would allow more control for odor management. And I think that this law would require that these facilities set their barns and lagoons back from the edge of their property. So if you, you know, have, I don't know, say 100 acres, you'd have to have it in the middle of that instead of on the edge of that, where, you know, maybe closer to the person's own house versus on the edge of their property where the smells can drift elsewhere. I know in Iowa there's been a lot of conversation about whether odor management works, which techniques work. You know, a lot of people put up trees, but then, you know, others say, hey, that might shield what we can see of this facility, but it does not necessarily shield the odors. So it will be interesting to see what the public comment period comes forward with in Wisconsin about those setbacks.
Jerry, thanks so much. Let's go to Stephen now, joining us from Bayview. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
So it's not, it's been a trend that we're getting hotter summers, and it's been more uncomfortable in summer. And one thing I've noticed is in areas that are downstream from these CAFOs, you get more algae blooms and you get more contamination all around. There's regulations in place, but they really don't protect, you know, all the lakes and ecosystems that are around the CAFOs.
Stephen, thanks. Erin, what can farmers do to manage runoff and attempt to keep the groundwater safe from contaminants?
Well, let me say, Stephen, first of all, your observation, it seems completely borne out by some of the early studies we've had. There was a U of I study, University of Iowa study this last year, looking at some of the areas in northwest Iowa with the highest number of CAFOs, and they had the highest levels of nitrate in the streams, which some people might say, well, duh, that makes sense. But it was kind of this first quantitative assessment of that. And I've been reporting right now about an area in western Ohio where they have a lot of animal production, and they have a lake there, Grand Lake, that's just been really struggling with algal blooms. And they implemented some bans on spreading manure during times when the ground is frozen, and they've put some new restrictions on farmers. And in addition to wetlands and other things they've implemented, they've really seen some improvements. So I think, you know, areas where residents are very concerned about those algal blooms and what it's doing to their recreation, I think there can be pressure applied in terms of when that manure is used.
You've also been covering the Gulf Hypoxia Task Force, this 12-state plan to reduce nitrate in the Mississippi River. What progress has been made there?
Yeah, that's a big reporting project that I did this last year with some students at Marquette University in Milwaukee. And we basically dug into what was happening in these 12 states, talked to a lot of officials, read their nutrient reduction plans. And what we discovered is in the 10 years since they made this commitment for the 45% reduction in nitrate and phosphorus, very little change has happened. Most of the states don't even have a baseline of what the nitrate and phosphorus was before. They don't know whether changes have happened. There is increased regulation on a lot of wastewater treatment plants, like city wastewater treatment plants or industries, but still, in most states, very little regulation, if any, on agriculture. And since that is, since those ag sources or the non-point sources are where a lot of the nitrate and phosphorus are coming from, there just really hasn't been much improvement.
We're talking with Erin Jordan. She's an investigative reporter for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. We're looking at CAFOs. She covers agriculture and water quality issues. Let's bring in Katie now, joining us from Janesville. Hi, Katie.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Just something to keep in mind with some of the CAFOs. There is technology out there for the farmers. It's very expensive at this point, but I can think of a couple different farms nearby that use dehydrators on the manure. They actually dehydrate the manure and then treat it, and they turn it back into bedding. They recycle everything on that farm. There's another one where they're called digesters. It's like a great big tub or container that has bacteria that actually breaks down all the manure so that it's safer to use or to be able to put back out on the land so that we don't have all the runoff. An example of that would be Rock County. We have a farm where we had a dairy breakfast, and the line was extremely long, and it wound right around the manure pit, and nobody even knew it was a manure pit.
Wow.
They couldn't see it. They couldn't smell it. But that farm, he uses the newer technology. In today's world with the dairy farms, they don't have the money coming in right now to be able to use that technology.
Katie, thanks. Yeah, thank you for the call. And I want to bring in Erin here. Biodigesters were just the way of the future. And, you know, around 2000, they came on the scene about. Is that right?
That sounds right. I mean, probably a few people were trying them that soon.
Yeah. Are farmers reluctant at all to use this type of advanced technology due to cost?
Yeah, I think what Katie describes is the fact, is just that it's too expensive for most operations. I just love the idea that she's, the picture she's painting of this breakfast where you're right there around the animals, but you don't smell them at all. You know, I know of one facility in northeast Iowa, so real close to the Wisconsin border, where they are trying to have a 10,000 head cattle operation and a digester. It's had real trouble getting started. So I don't know. I'm guessing that money is holding them up. But I mean, it's a great idea. The idea that you could generate methane from these digesters, that the waste product would be a lot easier to dispose of. But I think it's just the cost that's the main hurdle.
Well, as we start to wrap up here, we haven't really touched on cover crops and no-till farming. Are those practices on the rise at all here as we look at what to do with the waste?
Yeah, you know, a lot of farmers are really trying to be good stewards of their land, planting cover crops, which are basically like an off-season crop that protects the ground from erosion and helps reduce runoff. So in Wisconsin, there were 82,000 acres of federally subsidized cover crops, which is up from 60,000 acres in 2017. So that's a pretty big jump, but just to put that in perspective, that's still less than 1% of all the corn and soybean acres. So still just a very small portion of the land there. So the good news is there's a lot of room for improvement. And for each farmer who tries that, their neighbors see how it's working and can learn from that. I think the numbers I saw for 2018 for no-till were about 34,000 acres in Wisconsin.
Erin, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Kate.
Erin Jordan is an investigative reporter for the Gazette in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where she covers ag issues. We've been talking about CAFOs, these large livestock operations, and Wisconsin has several hundred livestock farms that would fall into this category. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.